Now, because this is a student lecture, it's intended to be a student lecture, we also encourage a student question period. So with that in mind, I'll now open up the floor. Okay, who can be honest? I'm sorry.
You mentioned that Foucault didn't really prescribe a normative set of ethics, but he did sort of have some sort of ethos that he subscribed to. I have a feeling you didn't really get to that in your lecture. Did it just go over my head?
No, I didn't get to it in my lecture. Thanks very much.
How did the election go, by the way?
That's good.
Yeah, so he actually, again, very typical of Foucault, when he turned to ethics, he said, well, we have to study ethics historically and as practices of various kinds, practices that where we enter into a relationship to ourselves and to others. And he gave us a way of studying historical forms of ethics around what he called four axes, which is very interesting way to think about ethics as the relationship we take out to ourselves and to others simultaneously, and work on ourselves and work on our relationship with others. I mean, it has a long history outside of Foucault, but it was an attempt to get out of these universal moral theories that are based on a idea of a set of universal laws and talk about ethics as practices of self-fashioning, or in Foucault's case, fashioning the relationships of gay communities where a lot of people were HIV positive and they're caring for each other. What kind of ethical conduct does one engage in cases like that? Or you want to help others, you have to catch the disease yourself, and so on. So he's kind of getting a situated form of ethics, getting typical of Foucault. He went back to Greeks to study Greek ethical practices, contrasted that with the Christians and then the post-Christian forms of ethical practices in the present. But you're absolutely right to say he didn't himself generate a normative moral theory of any kind. He saw himself deeply opposed to that. But he saw in this work on ethics, much like Bernie Williams in the English tradition, trying to open up a whole space of caring for the self and others, relationships. How do we work on these relationships we have to others? How do we make ourselves into an ethical subject by a set of ethical practices that we do either by ourselves or consciousness raising groups or in free trade relationships with people who are producing the coffee that we drink? How do we establish ethical relations? So ethics for him is a form of reflection on who you are as a person and the relationships with you, and at the same time a form of work or esquisses, as he calls it, of self-fashion. So I didn't go into that because that's a whole other topic that some people in the room know very well.
Anyone else that can jump in?
Do I need to use the microphone or can I just?
I think you do for the stream.
So in reading Foucault's later works, it's kind of interesting because he tells us that as part of an ethical practice, we need to practice on ourselves the idea of unlearning what we know. And what he makes this contrast between subjection and subjectivation, in his later work, if we take that contrast and we apply it to his earlier works, we then see it in the light of this new kind of meta question about the truth and the subject. And he says that's really kind of what he sees his whole work now being. It was just really trying to figure out how the subject is related to the truth. But then I think, so all this business about governmentality and disciplinary power and all of these things then seems to take on a completely different meaning in a whole new light. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I could a little bit, yeah. I'd like to speak to it a lot. And this, how we stand to subjects in relation to truth is really important for him because, again, especially in the archaeological writings, when we talk about modern scientific discursive formations, we mean big discursive formations like political sciences or political ecology or linguistics or psychoanalysis, which have within them truth claims or principles for testing what's true and false in that domain. Now, in the middle works, again, in the archaeological writings, Foucault didn't imagine, or at least didn't thematize, the subject's capacity to raise questions with respect to forms of testing truth claims in discourses. It made it look like we were more or less spoken by the discourse. And when he says, now the big question is, how does the subject stand in relation to truth in these different domains? It's this question of practices of freedom. What capacities do humans have to call into account not just a particular truth claim within a given domain, but the conditions for the testing rules, as Hegel calls them, for in a particular domain of knowledge? Do we have that capacity, freedom of thought, not just to raise questions in the classroom of vis-a-vis Foucault and Habermas, but a deeper question like, why are they even on the canon, right? Why should we take these people importantly at all? Why shouldn't we be asking somebody in downtown Victoria who's unemployed and living in a rape crisis center or something like that? Why aren't we asking them the political question? So he does the subject have this kind of what we might call second order capacity to challenge dominant background truth claims, what are given in any discourse? And that's, so you see that this practice of freedom has these two dimensions. On the one hand, we can all agree, sort of in a bourgeois sort of way, of course we have this room to maneuver within the educational system, modify it within to some extent. But do we have this capacity that Foucault tells us we have in the last quote, to call these background conditions into question? Big B background, in the sense they're what we silently acquire in virtue of being educated up in the system. Very fundamental background presuppositions or assumptions or capacities and so on. He wants to say, yes, there's not a sharp distinction between the foreground and the background here. But this is what he means by truth. He doesn't mean what are the true propositions. He means, again, like he always does in these third works, as you know very well, what are the practices of freedom in the domain of discursive practices available to us as subjects of them, the extent to which we can call them into question. He gives lots of very interesting examples. I mean, the most famous example, he's talking about the rise of the environmental movement in France. And he says, if you look carefully about how the environmental movement came to be listened to in the dominant scientific discourses in France, it was not by inventing a counter discourse, but by challenging assumptions of a more and more radical kind within the dominant modernist environmental discourse and entering in, bringing in deep ecological questions. So this is an example for him of how we can stand in this agonistic or critical relationship to the given conditions of making true and false claims within a dominant discourse. So I see that critical ethos as just an example in the domain of knowledge of ethical practices or political practices of freedom. And that's why in his last work, I mean, if I can just round this question off, because I think it's fascinating, the way he answered it was not, I mean, we can think of all his works as raising these very powerful questions about truth claims of the human sciences, that's what he did all his life. But he wrote this little book, as you know, called Fearless Speech, where he said, okay, what are the practices where humans have been able to speak truth to power, to not be completely subjectified by unequal relations of power, but rather to turn and speak truthfully or a different truth or a modified truth to those who have the capacity to interrupt the conversation, throw us in jail, or disappear us. And so again, it's this turn to practices of truth telling that is his answer, which is satisfying for some of us who have that pragmatic bent, but for some others who want a truce with content, so to speak, analytical tradition, he's no help at all. That's my view.
So the kind a pattern that seems to emerge from this notion of freedom and agency, and Foucault seems to be contingent on reflexivity itself. Like there's the possibility arises because there is a sort of reflexive turn within thought. I was wondering whether Foucault offered any reflections on reflexivity, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Sort of theory of what this means in itself. Like this capacity of reflexivity.
Yeah, that's a great question. A PhD student of mine did his PhD on practices of reflexivity historically. And really interesting thesis. Yeah, he... not any sustained treatment. He tells us, even in one of those quotes that I gave us, that we have this capacity for reflexive thought. That's not what inhabits everyday practices, but for Foucault, it's not completely discontinuous with us. When he gives that very powerful syndrome that we're able to stand back, detach ourselves from what we're thinking and doing, and reflect on it as an object or problematize it, he's saying we have these capacities, and you ask him, well, where do these capacities come from? His answer is, they come from the actual practice we're in. We acquire these capacities of reflexivity within the educational student in virtue of developing the capacities of becoming a student, doing our research, reflecting on Hobbes, Locke, Kant, Hegel, and so on. So these capacities, I mean, we have to have some background idea that humans have their capacities of some kind or another, but they come to historical fruition in virtue of being in a practical system of education of some kind where we develop them. So that reflexive turn, it's really interesting how he, if he had lived longer, how he would have accounted for it in detail without any transcendental account of human capacities in general. You could see the way he might have gone and imagine it yourself. But there isn't a work on it. There's just a promise that we have this capacity. And his whole critical ethos, all his writings are exemplary, as David Owen puts it, of that reflexive capacity that he inherits from Nietzsche, of turning around and turning a domain of knowledge and power into question. As he says, detaching self from the self. So we have kind of two radically different traditions of that reflexivity in the West, of situated reflexivity. One coming through Nietzsche and Foucault, and the other coming through Heidegger and Gadamer, slightly different kind. But still, radical freedom of thought consists precisely in this capacity we have to call into question forms of knowledge, relations of power, practices in which we find ourselves. Always limited and always have to start again, and always partial or historically situated, but nonetheless, it is a form of reflexivity. It's not the autonomous reflexivity you get in the critical theory tradition with Habermas and so on. It's very situated and partial, limited, historical, and so on. Contingent. But it's there in a very interesting way.
Yeah,
I
was like to jump in here. No. We move on past students now. We've exhausted that. We can, any professors have any questions? Anyone else in the audience?
Yeah, hope we have students. Just a question on you were speaking how there's sort of the first two stages of Foucault and how it sounds perhaps the third stage, there was a bit of a break there and he came around to sort of using to explain perhaps that his first two stages have been misread or misinterpreted. Now, is there some speculation as to whether truly the first two stages were misread by everybody that misunderstood what Foucault was trying to say, or was there an actual break in Foucault's thinking? Did he change himself in his own way of thinking from the first two stages to the third, and it wasn't a fact of misinterpreting his readings, it's just the fact that he had changed his interpretation?
Yeah, that's a good question. You don't get a definitive answer from Foucault himself. He tends to say there's not a sharp break here. He tends to say, I just haven't come around to the other side and looked at domains of knowledge, forms of power, modes of subjection from the side of those undergoing subjection. If I do that more closely, I'll see there's this field of possible conduct open for the subject in any body of knowledge relation of powers. And so then he says, I want to now add that third aspect onto my work as a whole. But others, quite a few others, had read the first two periods as saying that doesn't exist, right? We're constituted all the way down. And if you look at people, many people stop reading at the end of the second phase and say, let's try and find an account of agency in that very strong constructivist account in Discipline Punished, History of Sexuality. Wendy Brown, Judith Butler, a famous example of this, David Hoy. If we're going to find an account of agency in Foucault, we find it within the second period. And that's a whole different interpretation, there are lots of interpretations of Foucault, that goes off more or less independent from this third phase. Then you have a group of people who say, well, look, what he's doing in the third phase seems to be bringing in this completely different element. Whether he wants to say it's continuous or a break, it's different interviews. And he quite often says, I made a mistake. I thought in Discipline and Punish, relations of power act directly on the body and directly on the brain, like behaviorism, like B.F. Skinner. That's clearly not the case. They act on actions, and he opens that space up. At other times, he says, he apologizes for studying power and knowledge just from the side of those who oppose it, rather from the side who undergo it. So many, he's willing to say, the whole first two parts are missing this element. But he doesn't make it a radical break. It's not like John Locke, who halfway through life said, the first half I was completely wrong, here's the new Locke, or like Wittgenstein, first book. Spent the second half of life criticizing the first book. For Foucault, you would think, as a philosopher of discontinuity, he would be happy to say, you know, make a sharp break, but he doesn't. He says clearly, I see things more clearly, I have a better view, I've modified this, here are the two big mistakes of the period. There's an unpublished preface to volume 2 of The History of Sexuality, which of course has now been published many times, but where he's the most, he really does go back to his early works and said, here's what I've left out. Very interesting. It's the most Heideggerian of his texts. Very short, just 12 pages long. But very, very important for trying to understand how he saw the relationship of the third period to the second and the first. Yes, Noah.
I guess the question I've had with Foucault for a long time is this. He's always giving us particular descriptions of situations, such as in a prison. And that has to do with him being a not so much an analytic philosopher, but I guess what we call social sciences in North America. He's studying particular empirical examples. So the question is if he had ever been in a situation of making a totalizing claim, or if even in his third period he can be as well. So I think it should be that sometimes power does act directly on the body, but sometimes it doesn't and involves mediation through people's own conduct. I suppose if I were to spend years and years and years researching this, I'd find different examples. Is he committed to any sort of totalizing claim which would contradict that kind of approach?
Well, he's committed to a kind of stipulative claim about how he's using the term power in the subject of power and on from that. But power is, by definition, the way we act on free agents. We're governed through our freedom as moderns in this sense. And then he says, if a relationship acts directly on the body, it's a relationship of force, or it's a relationship of violence, or it's a structure of domination. So there are three possibilities, and he says, I don't want to include within the conception of power relations of force, relations of violence, background structures of domination. Of course, when I enter into an educational system and I spend my life there and I become a professor and I become shaped and formed as a professor and I this form of subjectivity becomes second nature to me. In virtue of coming into that educational system, a whole background, big B background, comes into place, which I am unaware of as a student, and great aspects of it, I'm unaware of it, or hasn't mediated through my thought process. And that's a feature of practices, in the same way it is for people like Buddha and so on. So he's not saying the whole ensemble is mediated through my thought process in a kind of hyper-Sartrean way. No. We start within the field, and the field's given. It's a background structure of domination for Foucault, which I haven't had time to go into. But in virtue of the free play within the foreground relations of power, the question and answer and so on, we have the capacity to work ourselves back, to problematize not just particular curriculum in political science 509 or 402 in a particular year, but the whole ensemble by this radical reflexivity, again, to a limited degree. So maybe I misunderstand, maybe I mispresented the role that thought plays. It's not a kind of Archimedean form, but it's there in every practice, he says, no matter how habitual. And thought has this capacity of reflexivity or turning on itself or turning on, what you call in that quote, its conditions. Yes?
No,
I'm fine.
Well, as I promised, this question period was strictly monitored, which means it's time for our second presenter, so I'd like to extend another thank you to Dr. Holly.